This audio trail will take you around 1.5 hours to complete, depending on how fast you walk. Of course, you can always do part now and return another time to complete the tour. The start point is the gap where the field behind the hill joins Troopers Hill itself. So if you are not already there, I'm afraid you will need to either make your way up to the chimney at the top, then follow the path to the gap, or, if you are already at the field, cross towards the play slide in the far corner. Please start the rest of the audio guide once you are at the gap. Welcome to the local nature reserve of Troopers Hill. It was declared a nature reserve in 1995, and at the time of recording this guide, is the only local nature reserve in Bristol to have been awarded a green flag. This audio guide has been produced by the Friends of Troopers Hill. The Friends of Troopers Hill is a group of mainly local interested people who work in partnership with Bristol Parks to ensure that Troopers Hill Local Nature Reserve is maintained as a nature reserve of benefit to both wildlife and people. Before you move on to the hill itself, turn around and look behind you. You see an open space. In 2005, the Friends of Troopers Hill carried out a survey to find out what local people's wishes for this area were. Amongst the questions we asked was, what do you call this space? Until then, it had been designated Malvern Road Open Space by Bristol City Council. The most popular name used was Troopers Hill Field. Subsequently, the council officially adopted this name. People's views really do matter. To the right, behind a fence, you can see Troopers Hill Farm allotments. In fact, some years ago, the whole field was also allotments. The hill and adjacent land was purchased by Bristol City Council in 1956. The hill was reserved as public open space, but the field and the woods to your left were used as a tip. And when the old market underpass at the end of Castle Street was being created in the 1960s, the spoil was brought here and dumped. The field area was then capped with clay and the recreation area created. Now turn back towards the hill and proceed along the path straight ahead. Just before you get to a bench on the right, take the left fork. You can stop this guide until you reach the interpretation board on the top of the hill. This interpretation board shows you the layout of Troopers Hill itself and the adjoining woods. You can also see some examples of the wildlife that might be seen on the hill. This guide is going to take you all the way down to the road at the very bottom corner by Cruise Hole Road, and then back up to the top. So I hope you're wearing appropriate footwear. There are also some steep edges, more on those later. So please take care if you wander from these directions. Immediately ahead, you can probably see the mast at Dundry, and to the left of it, if the weather's favourable, you may be able to see the distant Mendip transmitter mast at Penn Hill in Somerset. Closer in, you can see the water tower at Knowles straight ahead of you. Further to the right, you'll probably see the spire of St Mary Redcliffe, reputedly referred to by Queen Elizabeth I as the fairest, goodliest and most famous parish church in England. Beyond that, you can probably see the manor house at Ashley Court on the far side of Bristol. It is this view that makes Troopers Hill such a great place to come and watch the Bristol Balloon Fiesta mass ascents. When you're ready, please move to your left and stand in front of the chimney, looking down the hill. You can pause the audio until you're there. What you see in front of you has changed considerably in the last 60 years. To the right, you see extensive woodlands. In the 1950s, all this area would have been open hillside, like the hill itself. You would have seen groups of cottages, now gone, and Malvern Road along the top of the ridge. Below, on both sides of the riverbank, you would have seen considerable industrial works. Here's Rob Acton Campbell to explain more.
If you stand with your back to the arch of the chimney, you can see a furrow in the ground running down away from you. This went down to a copper smelting works down by the river. It was a covered duct that zigzagged its way up the hill. We think the chimney was built in the 1790s for what was then a new copper smelting works. There were older works along by the Bull Inn, and in fact the first copper smelting works in the valley were at Conham. They started in the late 1600s. By the middle of the 1700s, the Crew's Hole and Conham by the River Avon were the most important places in Bristol for producing copper. The copper was then used to make brass, and the brass was used in the slave trade. So that you could say that Crew's Hole was the driver behind Bristol's wealth in that time, which came from the slave business. In the late 1700s, the copper works in the valley at Crew's Hole closed when the brass company decided to move its main works over to Warmley. This was a works that had been built by William Champion, but it had gone bust, and the brass company at Crew's Hole bought it. The land of the old works by the river in Crew's Hole was then leased to various companies. We believe that one of these started a new copper smelter, and that was where the chimney was built. This copper smelter didn't last all that long. The land again became derelict and again was leased to various companies. In the end, it was sold in 1826. Following this, more companies moved in. One of these, starting in 1843, was Butler's Tower Works. Butler's Tower Works was built mainly to produce creosote for the Great Western Railway. In fact, it's believed that Isambard Kingdom Brunel was involved in setting it up. William Butler had worked for Brunel as a manager on the railway down towards Exeter. Creosote was a preservative of timber, and obviously there was a lot of timber forming the track between Bristol and London, so that Brunel would have been very interested in the preservative to keep the railway in good shape for a long time. This became the main industry on this side of the river. It was in the area where you can see the new housing on our side of the river. As well as the tar works, there were a chemical works, and further down a lead smelter and a pottery, so that the area around the river was very industrial, and the valley would have been full of smoke and fumes. In fact, some people believe that the tar fumes were good for your health, and we've heard stories of people being brought up onto the hill to breathe in the tar fumes to help with bronchitis. Over the years, Butler's Tar Works expanded and took over the site of the various other industries, so that by the 1980s, it was operating on the whole of the area below the chimney by the river. However, the area actually where the chimney duct came down wasn't taken over by Butler's until probably nearly the Second World War, so Butler's themselves never actually used the chimney. On the other side of the river, where again there is new housing now, stood St Anne's Board Mills. This was opened during the First World War, and its main aim was producing cardboard, which was used for cigarette packets. Again, this works was operational until about 1980 or 1981, when it also closed. Along with the tar works, both these areas were then demolished and the new housing built that you can see now. There's a lot more information about the history of Troopers Hill, Crew's Hole and the works around the River Avon on the history page of our website.
Now, move behind the chimney and across to the path at the back of the hill by the trees. Turn right and go down the steps to the bottom corner by the flagpole. You can pause playback now, and we'll pick up our story when you get there. You are now standing by the corner of Greendown and Troopers Hill Road. This is where friends of Troopers Hill meet for their regular work parties at 10 a.m. on the first Saturday of every month. You would be very welcome to join us for a couple of hours light work and a cup of coffee afterwards. The flag on the flagpole you see in front of you is the green flag. This is similar to the blue flag awarded to beaches and is awarded to green spaces that achieve a suitably high standard. So far, Troopers Hill has been awarded a green flag every year since 2007 and was one of the first two green spaces in Bristol to be awarded one, the Downs being the other. We are very proud of this award as it underlines the value and quality of the efforts being made by both Bristol City Parks Department and the Friends of Troopers Hill, and our ongoing commitment. On the right, running down the hill towards you, you can see a hedge that the Friends planted in 2006. It was initially planted to reinforce the old wooden fence that ran along this side of the local nature reserve. As you can see, it has established very successfully. Friends subsequently raised a grant in 2008 to replace the wooden fence and entrance in this corner with the current estate-type fence, which will last considerably longer. Now continue to your left along a path by the roadside. In approximately 100 yards, you'll take the right fork. Continue along that fork for about another 100 yards into the valley, and then stop and listen to the next section. You are now standing in an area we refer to as the Gully. Troopers Hill was an important industrial resource long before it became valuable as a nature reserve. The bedrock on the hill is Pennant sandstone, and it was heavily quarried for over 100 years, ending in the early 1900s. As you look at the steep stone faces around you, you can almost imagine the sounds of pickaxes striking rock and the shouts of the men as they would have laboured around where you are now standing. In fact, some of the mounds further over to your left are actually spoil heaps, left over when the rock was extracted and sent off for building projects. It is likely that the Wesley Memorial Church on Brian's Hill was made from sandstone extracted here. We don't know if the stone was dressed here or whether that would have been done on site, but you can imagine trolleys being pulled by donkeys, or perhaps just the men themselves, heaving the great rocks along the gully and down Troopers Hill Road to the river at the bottom. There, they would have been loaded onto barges and transported down into Bristol itself and other places for use in buildings. Look at the colour of the rock up to your right. The red tinge is probably caused by high iron content when the rock was laid down. The brighter red areas are where the rock has broken away most recently. You will notice that there's a lot of heather here in the gully. There is also a substantial area of important grasses. A few years ago, there were several trees that had been allowed to take root and grow here in this valley, as well as elsewhere on the nature reserve. These trees shaded substantial areas of the heathland, resulting in a decrease of the areas of grass and heather, and also spreading seedlings, which would then grow into more trees. Look at the rock on the left as you go along the path. You should see four main outcrops, unless they are temporarily hidden behind some overgrown scrub. Now look closely at the first outcrop. See the light green on the face of it? Justin Smith tells us more about that.
We're in the gully on Troopers Hill here. Plenty of rock exposures and bare heathy soil. And you'll find there's lots of lichens growing on the surface of the rocks here. The lichens themselves represent unusual organisms in the fact they're two species, a fungus and a green alga or cyanobacterium, used to be known as blue-green algae. These can produce various structures on where they grow. Sometimes they're shrub-like or leaf-like. The particular ones on these rocks here are known as crustose lichens. They're crustose because they just form a crust on the surface. And if you look closely at the rocks, you'll see two species that are quite eye-catching. These, unfortunately, they've just got Latin names. There's no English names for a lot of these species. So the blue-grey one is Porpidia tuberculosa, and the yellowish-green, much brighter thing that you see here is Silolechia lurida. Both species are common, mostly found on what's known as acid rocks. Acid rocks are, they've got quite a low pH, but they usually have lots of quartz and things like that in there. But these are sandstones because there's lots of quartz there. And these particular lichens, they seem to like this type of rock. Lichens are fairly fast-growing organisms, and because of that, they can be used as environmental indicators. They can tell us an awful lot about what's going on in our woodlands and grasslands and whatever else. And one of those things is the air quality. A lot of species are very, very sensitive to what the air quality is like, whether there's any pollutants or dust or anything like that. And so some of the cleanest air areas within the UK have the biggest diversity of lichen species. Places like northwest Scotland, northwest Wales, Devon, Cornwall, Pembrokeshire, places like that. Because Troopers Hill, by its very nature, is in the vicinity of Bristol, and there's loads of farmland around as well, there's been a long history of extra pollutants being in the air that does affect the lichens that you find there. But saying that, you can actually come onto a place like this and you can find 30, 40, 50 species if you looked closely. Now, those species that you find here are either going to be tolerant of pollutants that are in the air, or they are species that actually prefer to grow in those conditions. The one pollutant that, you know, traditionally we've always been worried about is sulfur dioxide that used to come out of the coal-fired power stations. But that's in big decline now. Theoretically, we're in a lot cleaner air. But the one pollutant that is very evident in the natural environment is nitrogen. And nitrogen can be sourced from farming, from intensive farming, through ammonia and fertilizers and things like that. But then also from transport as well, nitrous oxides and nitrous dioxides. And they can affect the natural environment to a very strong degree. And certainly a lot of the species that you find on Troopers Hill are those species that will be a mix of the tolerant and a mix of the loving of those nitrogen, those excess nitrogen conditions. Because by their very nature they're growing on the surface of exposed stone, they are outcompeted by a lot of coarser plants such as ivy and bramble and things like that. So, you know, you'll find that as the amount of exposed stone declines, as the vegetation covers it, then those lichens in turn will also decline because they just can't compete with bigger plants, really.
Now, move a little further along to the fourth rocky outcrop. The almost horizontal lines about 2 feet from the bottom are actually a fossil of a tree. Andrew Matheson will give us more information about these rocks. So restart this audio when you get there.
We're standing in the gully a few yards south of the chimney at the top of Troopers Hill, and we're looking at some rocks on the south side of the quarry. And we can feel the rock, and it is rough to the touch. It's sandy, it's a sandstone. Near the bottom of the face of rock, there are two pieces of fossil tree trunk or branch, just about half a metre off the ground, running parallel to the surface of the ground. They're quite long, they've got ridges along the length, and I suspect they're from the tallest trees of the rainforest of the time, perhaps 30 metre high trees, forming a canopy in these swampy conditions. But when we look carefully in this particular bit of rock, we can find little lumps of coal. So it looks like the coal was formed and then broken up and stuck together again in new layers of sand. And all this helps us to think about how these rocks formed. Originally sand, coal, trees. And we can get sand in lots of places, by the beach or by a river, but where there are trees and coal being formed, it suggests forests and peat deposits, because that's what we think coal was formed from. And we think that when this was soft sand about 300 million years ago, this area was covered with forests, that there were swampy areas, there were rivers moving, sand was being carried around, and it was totally different to the present day. In fact, we think Britain was on the equator at that time. Now, the coal we find in fragments here is also found in seams, in layers. The old miners around here call them veins. And there's perhaps about a dozen veins of coal between the bottom of Troopers Hill by the river and Air Balloon Hill Road. Some of them were perhaps 2 metres thick, others just a few centimetres thick. But there was a lot of coal, and it's been mined for centuries. And also, unusually here, fire clay has been mined. That's the clay beneath coal seams. And 3 layers of fine clay were mined. Evidence of the stuff the trees were growing in at the time, a thick clay, which has been really useful for the bricks that line furnaces. It can resist heat.
Make your way further along the gully until you come to a cliff wall facing you. Restart this recording when you get there, as Andrew has some more to tell you.
We've come further along the gully to the largest rock face, and you can see really clearly here the layering in the sandstone. If you look at it carefully, it's not dead flat, smooth lines. It's waves around a bit, and this all suggests that the sand grains in the rock were carried by running water, and they moved around and shifted the sand grains as they went. Now, this sandstone is called Pennant, and this is a name which is for use all around Bristol and the coalfield areas, in the Forest of Dean coalfield and the South Wales coalfield. And the name goes back at least 300 years and is said to be from two Welsh words, Pen Nant, head of the valley. Now, another thing you can see here, of course, is the fact that these original layers of rock would have been flat, but they're tilted steeply to the south, down towards the river. And this is the result of massive movements of the earth crust, sometime after these rocks were formed and hardened. The forces which compressed and buckled up these rocks presumably were linked with the way that the earth's crust was moving around. We know today with plate tectonics the Atlantic Ocean is opening steadily all the time, and elsewhere the rocks are being compressed, and it's these massive forces, the crust of the earth shifts around, which has the power to tilt and bend and break these rocks. And it's affected all the rocks around here. All through Kingswood you have an arched fold running east-west, and this is the south side of that big structure. But similar things you find in the Mendip Hills. All the rocks have been folded in an east-west direction, so they're either tipping to the south or to the north, and that gives us our ridges of high ground to the south and west of Bristol. The plate tectonics of years ago aren't so easy to understand as they are today, but when we look at where there is coal in Europe and North America, you can almost draw a straight line on a map and then push all these countries and continents back together, and you realise that coal was formed in a belt, and that belt has now been split up thanks to all these earth movements which have pulled the Atlantic Ocean apart and compressed and folded rocks elsewhere.
Now for a long stroll. Look to your left and you'll see a gap in the gully sidewall. Please take the track up through that and then make your way right on down the path and steps to the very bottom corner of the nature reserve, where you'll find another chimney. Pick up the guide again when you get there. Okay, the chimney you're standing next to is yet another relic of the industrial past. Here's Rob again to explain why.
The chimney in front of you now was built in around 1805 for a coal mine. This was actually one of two very similar structures. The other one was further up Troopers Hill Road. On the interpretation board in front of you, you can see a drawing of what it would have looked like. Both these structures had steam engines, or as they were called then, fire engines. These were used mainly for pumping water out of the pits, though they may also have been used for lifting the coal. These pits were very deep shafts, sort of traditional coal mining. In fact, the shafts ran out under the river, and when the new housing was built at Butler's Wharf, they actually found one of the old pit shafts when they did a trial borehole. Kingswood was, of course, a great centre for coal production, and it was the coal in the area that was one of the reasons that copper ore smelting and other industries came to the area. It was much cheaper to bring copper ore to where the coal is than to take the coal to the copper ore, since you need far more tonnage of coal. The chimney was referred to by Elizabeth Emra in her book written in 1830, and she was concerned about the fact that they'd built this steam engine or fire engine and destroyed the peace and quiet of an area she knew when she was young. The black blocks that form the corners of the chimney are actually residue from the copper smelting. You can see on the interpretation board a picture of the Black Castle at Brislington, which is also built from these blocks. This was an early form of recycling, since prior to this, the remains from the copper smelting had just been dumped on the side of the river. And the council, even in the 1700s, were complaining about the mess it was leaving and the fact that it might block the river.
Please now return back up the steps, past the bramble on your right. When you get to the top of the first set of steps, you can take a moment to sit on the bench facing the hill and listen to the next section. From this bench, you get a wonderful view looking up the hill. Most people are familiar with the view from the top, but friends installed this bench so that you can both have a rest and enjoy an ever-changing view. Here's Dawn Lawrence.
We're looking up at the south side, more or less, of Troopers Hill, and it's a big sandstone hill rising above the River Avon Valley. And we can see gorse, and we can see quite a bit of broom and some bracken. Starting in spring, when all the fresh green growth comes out, the grassland is spangled with brightly coloured wildflowers like the red clover, the white clover, we've got the yellow bird's foot trefoil. The yellows of the broom and the gorse will come out and clothe the hillside. And then as you move through into summer, the heather will come out. And we have two types of heather, which is the bell heather, which is a brilliant purple, more towards the top of the hill. And then lower down the slopes, you've got great swathes of the paler mauvey lilac of the ling heather. And then going through into autumn, the bracken will start going brown, and we get all the browns and golds of the heathers, the silver birch trees turning yellow, and all the other trees as they fade into winter. The reason that the plants are here, these particular plants here, particularly the heathers, is because the underlying soil is acidic. and that's because the rock is sandstone. So we get what we call a heathland here, which is characterised by lots and lots of heather, and the gorse and the broom are other very, very typical plants of this type of habitat. And in the Bristol area, it's actually very rare to find any heathland at all, because we're surrounded by limestones and neutral clays. So this is a really special and unusual habitat for Bristol. This type of heathland needs to be looked after in order to preserve the special species that are here. The things like the heather and the low broom and the gorse, they all need sunlight in order to thrive. And if they get shaded over by a dense growth of trees, they'll all die. And all the special species that they support, the insects and so on, will die with them. So this kind of habitat needs some type of management. And at Troopers Hill, what is carried out is called scrub bashing. And that means chopping back any invading shrubs and then trees which are taking over. And that could include bramble or broom or sallows or even things that are bigger like hawthorns and ash and silver birches if they're growing in the wrong place. If this type of management isn't carried out, then what will happen is that perhaps the bracken, the taller plants like the hawthorns and the ash will eventually take over, and all of the plants that rely on the sunlight will be shaded out. So the heather will disappear, the lower plants such as the birdsfoot trefoil will disappear, and we will end up with just thick scrub that you can't even walk through. Once the scrub has closed over, then the trees start growing through it, and then you'll end up with thick woodland. The important thing about the management is that we're trying to get a balance of the different habitats. Each different habitat supports its different plants. The heathland supports the heather, the scrub supports the gorse and the broom, and then there's even taller scrub at the edges with hawthorn and sallows. And once you get the balance of all the different habitats right, then you've got a really good mix for the plants, and also that means for the invertebrates, the insects and so on, and the other animals.
Carry on up the hill towards a bare patch you'll be able to see towards the middle and to the right of the next set of steps. When you get to the bare patch, stop and have a good look at it. Then listen to the next part of the guide. If you're lucky, and depending on the time of year you are visiting, look for some small holes about a quarter of an inch in diameter in the ground. These are mining bee burrows. And if you lay on the ground and look closely, you may start to see many of them buzzing around. Rupert Higgins tells us more about the fauna on Troopers Hill.
Troopers Hill, although it's in an urban setting, is one of the most important sites in the whole of Britain for some groups of insects. And what we've got here that is particularly special is the combination of the heath with the heathers and the grassy patches, with the areas of woodland, even what look like rather scruffy areas with rose bay willow herb or bits of thistles or bramble, they're all important. And one thing which you might not even think of as a habitat for wildlife that is very, very important are the bits of bare soil around the paths where people walk, where the ground's very steep and gets scuffed. Those are vitally important for a whole range of insects. The most diverse, the most unusual group here are little mining bees. These are solitary bees. So they're most of them about half the size of a honeybee, but look rather like a honeybee, but they don't live in a hive. What they do is they dig a little hole in the soil, and that's one reason why they need these bare patches of bare earth, so they can dig. And if you look on your hands and knees, you can see tiny little holes that these bees have dug. If you come here in the springtime, nice sunny day in late April, early May, you'll see whole areas of the hill are alive with these tiny bees. And if you look really closely, you'll see it's not just one sort. You might see maybe a dozen sorts of bees. And then what's equally special is the insects that live with them, a lot of them preying on them. We get special types of wasps here, beetles, and in particular a bee fly. So this is quite a big fly that looks rather like a bee itself. It's called spotted bee fly. The young of it, its larvae, feed on these solitary bees. to sustain these populations of predators and parasites that live with the bees, you need really big populations of these bees, not just 10 or 20, but you need hundreds, possibly thousands of them. You're only going to get that in a site where there's a really good area of the habitat. So in this case, what we're looking at is the heathland and the grassy areas. But combined with that are the less attractive areas, the scrub, because things like the sallows and the hawthorns are a vital source of nectar in the spring for the bees. So you put that all together, it's a really unusual combination of habitats, and that's why it's such a special site for these insects. It's not just the bees and their predators we get here. In the later summer, it's full of grasshoppers, bush crickets. We've recorded well over 100 species of moths here in one night when we've come here with moth traps. It's a great site for butterflies, butterflies like common blue and small copper, brown argus, small heath. Again, all things that are particularly associated with the fine grassland and the heathland. One of the most remarkable things here is that someone found a species of fly that's not known anywhere else in Britain. It's rather odd because it's very much associated with a plant called rock stone crop, which isn't native to Britain. It's a garden plant which quite often escapes. It's not that rare as a plant in the wild, but apparently Troopers Hill is the only place in Britain where this fly is associated with it. I should say it's a very small fly, not something that you or I would notice, but it is here. One of the few sites in Bristol now where there are good populations of reptiles, in particular common lizard, which is another species that likes the sunny, dry heathland slopes of the site. The common lizards can be quite easy to spot basking in the sunlight on a warm but not too hot day. Slow worms occur around the edges of the hill. Best chance of seeing them is lifting over a stone or a log or something, always remembering to put it back, of course, for the animals that live underneath it. If you do lift something like that, what you're most likely to see in the summer is an ant's nest. You can watch the ants scurrying around, saving their pupae, their young, from the disturbance that you've caused. And again, of course, if you do lift something like that, please put it back again, because it'll be the home for a lot of things, some of which you probably won't even see. There used to be adders here, and a couple of people have told me there still are. You're very, very unlikely to see them. They'll get out of your way long before you stumble across them, and I've never seen one here.
Now it's time to tackle those steps on your left. Climb the first group and have a seat on the next bench on the left as you go up. Check back with us when you get there. Glad you made it. Have a rest and listen to Justin Smith again.
Fungi are organisms that were grouped with plants for a long time until biologists kind of acknowledged that to be a plant, you need to be photosynthesizing. So you need to be green, have green parts that trap the light and create energy from that. Fungi don't do that. Fungi are very unusual organisms that we only really detect when they produce something called their fruit bodies. Most of us are familiar with seeing mushrooms and toadstools out and about, but other strange and weird shapes will appear as well. There's balls and coral shapes and bracket fungi, dead man's fingers, all things like that. They are very interesting organisms because the majority of species just feed on dead matter. So dead plants, leaves, logs, trees, stumps, anything like that. And then another group of fungi that actually live in a relationship with plant species and with tree species. We're at this particular spot here by the birch tree because in the autumn time, which is the main time when the majority of the larger fungi will produce their fruit bodies, the mushroom and toadstool types, we have a species here called the fly agaric. And the fly agaric is quite an eye-catching beast. It's red with white spots and a white stem, and it grows in a direct relationship with birch trees mostly, often with other trees as well, but on Trooper's Hill it's growing with birch, and it will often form a patch or almost a ring growing around the birch tree. Now, very interestingly, the fly agaric, its name actually comes about from the French used to use it as a fly killer. They used to soak the fungus in milk, and because it contains quite a lot of poisons in there, the flies used to come down and they used to drink from the milk, and they become almost stupefied, a little bit drunk from drinking this milk with the fly agaric in it, and they were easy to swat then. So that's how he gets his name, the fly agaric. It's well known for being a poisonous species. It's been often used in shamanic rituals in Northern Europe and in parts of Siberia, wherein the shaman or religious person within a lot of villages would take the fly agaric and then travel to the different worlds to get messages from the dead and whatever else. And very interestingly, the fly agaric was used to herd in reindeer as well. Little caps were laid on the ground and the deer would munch it and then arrive back to base by just munching on these fly agarics. A lot of people think that the whole Santa Claus image, the red and white costume, may well come from the fly agaric. The very fact that in the Sami peoples of northern Finland and northern Norway, when they used to practice shamanism, the shaman used to arrive on a sleigh, often drawn by reindeer, jingle bells when he arrived in the village, and it's often said that he would see little people that would pass messages between the different worlds, which of course could be the elves that people use for packing Christmas presents, Santa uses for packing Christmas presents. So it's got a lot of these kind of folkloric context to it that originate from its appearance and how obvious it was, and in a way it's probably one of the most familiar of fungi for a lot of people, because certainly in children's tales like Enid Blyton and Beatrix Potter, if there was little goings on in the woods, you'll often find the fly agaric being the mushroom that's illustrated in those books. When you're walking over Trooper's Hill in the autumn time, September to November, you'll probably find loads of different fungi, various sizes, just dotted around on there. Bear in mind, a lot of them are very difficult to identify, and an awful lot are very, very poisonous as well. So if you're really not sure on what you're doing, just leave them where they are. The other issue, certainly in conservation terms, is often picking mushrooms and taking everything that you see, actually leave nothing behind for people to see and for other animals that might depend on those fungi to feed, especially as the nights are kind of drawing in the autumn time coming into winter. So it's probably best to take nothing but photographs and leave nothing but footprints on Trooper's Hill.
Now, turn around and look at the steps you've been climbing. Here's Susan Acton Campbell from the Friends of Trooper's Hill to tell you a bit more about them.
We're a volunteer group that work very closely with the landowners of this site, Bristol City Council. We work to promote Trooper's Hill, to encourage people to visit it, to enjoy it, to care for it. To achieve this, we raise grants to cover the events that we run, and also to carry out pieces of work that will particularly improve access to the hill. The steps you came up just now probably wore you out a little. Well, you should have seen them in 2010. You would have looked at the difference in heights of the steps and perhaps been totally put off coming up here. The gaps in height between the steps were anything up to 18 inches. If you were lucky enough to be here during a rainstorm, you would have seen a cascade of water descending down the steps, washing away yet more of the path. And there were problems like this around most of the steps and paths on the hill, but this was the worst example. There was a grant that we might be suitable to apply for. And we had a look, and the first part of the exercise was quite straightforward. Fill in a form with what you want. So the friends got together and decided what we wanted to do was improve access to the hill. And access meant just not only improving the steps and the paths, but we also wanted people to know more about the hill, so interpretation boards came into it, and very few people knew about the woodland trail. There are two paths going through the woodland that really extend your walk around the hill and are beautiful in themselves. Stage two was all about proving that this was the right thing to do on a local nature reserve and had wide local support. So we employed an ecologist using grant money, to examine the options about the paths and the steps. We also created a questionnaire, and volunteers kindly went out and delivered 2,000 questionnaires to houses all in the immediate vicinity. The ecologist came back with the answer that yes, exactly the right thing to do was to maintain the steps along and paths along the routes they currently follow. This was best for the nature in the site. And we had great response to our questionnaire. Response to paper questionnaires is normally extremely poor. For us to achieve over 25% response was really magnificent, and we're really grateful to local people. And over 95% of responses were totally in favour of restoring the steps and paths and showing people clearly the woodland paths. And we were really delighted when we heard that over £30,000 had been awarded for the project. As you go further up the steps, you'll come to a very beautifully carved wooden marker, which is the first of the woodland trail markers. We were particularly pleased with this trail. The wooden markers are recycled beams of a wood called pitch pine, which is very dense and solid and will hopefully last for many, many years. And each of the posts, there's four of them, have been carved with images to reflect certain aspects of Troopers Hill. Because we had done so well in this spending of the money, we also were awarded another £3,500. So there's now a fun learning trail developed with local schools on the hill. And we're in the process of sorting out a tree trail. You may well see some labels on trees as you go around the woodland paths.
It's time to continue up the steps. You'll see the trail marker Susan referred to after a few more steps. Have a good look at it and see if you can make out the carvings on the sloping face. It's easier if the light is just right or if the wood is wet. Then take the track to the left and continue along the side of the woods. This path will take you through a small glade with broom on your right and a more open area on your left. Friends have named this Sally's Glade, after Sally Oldfield from Bristol City Council, who was responsible for setting the group up in 2003. She organised our first work party to clear bramble and scrub in this glade and encourage the broom and other wildflowers. As you'll see, that project has been successful. Enjoy the peace and quiet in the glade. And then carry on until you come to another trail marker and a bench on your right at the top of some steps. Sit down there and listen to the next instalment. This location we call Little Elizabeth's View, after Elizabeth Emra, who lived nearby in the early 1800s. Rob referred to her earlier. She wrote a book, Scenes in Our Parish, the first part of which was published in 1830. In it, she wrote of Troopers Hill, "The barren and quarried hill, with its yellow spots of gorse and broom, and its purple shade of heath, raising itself above the dark heaps of dross on our own side, and then the river, the beautiful, soft, flowing river that we have all loved so well." This is a particularly good place to sit and watch the river quietly making its way to the floating harbour in Bristol. As you watch, you may see some boats making their way upriver towards Bath or down to Bristol. Imagine the scene 250 years ago, with the river busy with barge traffic bringing copper ore for smelting from Devon or Cornwall to the furnaces below you by the river, carrying stone from Troopers Hill down to be used in building in the city. The river here would have been tidal. It's only partly tidal now, thanks to the floating harbour, completed in 1809. So the boats would probably all have been going the same way at the same time, depending on the flow of water. The Friends of Troopers Hill actually handmade the bench you were sitting on several years ago, using traditional woodworker's tools, and installed it here so that you can enjoy the view. While you're here, sit quietly and try and identify any birds you can hear. The woods are a particularly good place to listen, especially in the spring. Here's Ed Druitt to tell us about some.
So looking out across Troopers Hill Nature Reserve at this particular point, we're looking out across the city, and what is immediately obvious that right in front of us, although we've got this opening here, there are lots and lots of nice small shrubby type trees and also smaller plants as well. And this in turn provides a brilliant feeding and nesting habitat for birds. And whatever time of the year that you're here at Troopers Hill, you can pretty much guarantee that around here there will be birds such as song thrushes, blackbirds, robins. Throughout the year, lots of different birds will be singing, particularly during the springtime, but also perhaps during the winter too. The birds are singing to proclaim a territory. They're saying, this is my area, this is my land. They're also doing it to attract a mate as well. So very early in the season, they're going to be saying to female birds, come and mate with me, this is my territory. But then once they've got a mate on eggs or they've got babies, they'll then be protecting that territory from other male birds, so they've got enough food and enough territory to feed their chicks and their mate. But when you're walking through here, how do you identify those birds? Well, a lot of it is by sound. And for example, the robin, which is a bird that you may get in a lot of the gardens locally around here as well, with its red breast and its brown back, has a very sort of laid back, quite casual song really. Sounds a bit sad as well when it's singing. But it has these little phrases with lots of gaps in between as it's listening for other robins. And this is what it sounds like. Another bird that you'll get here is the blackbird. This is one of my favourite birds. This has a beautiful, melodic, fluty sounding song. And again, like the robin, will also tend to sort of pause after its phrases. The key thing with both the robin and the blackbird is that they will also sing in the autumn and throughout the winter. So even if you're here away from the breeding season, you can hear them singing. So this is the blackbird. I mentioned another bird as well, the song thrush. This is a bird that loves to feed on snails, and they tend to smash the snails against a stone called an anvil. You're listening for a bird that's repeating a short sound three or four times before then changing to a slightly different sound. A very common bird here at Troopers Hill is the chaffinch. This is a little bit bigger than a robin, with a reddy-orange breast, a lovely blue-grey head and a greenish rump. And when it's singing, it sounds like it's almost like a bowling ball being sort of a person running up to a green and then letting the ball roll. And the song is almost sort of descending downward to this bowl as this bowling ball is running along the ground. In the spring and summertime, blackcaps and chifchaffs come here from southern Europe and northern Africa, while in the wintertime, redwings and fieldfares, types of thrushes, will spend the winter here throughout the cold months. And so Troopers Hill is actually a very important place for birds both coming here after their migration, but also passing through. Because it's very high up above sea level, you'll also get lots of birds such as meadow pipits, variety of finches and wheatears passing through on migration. Now the blackcap is a robin-sized bird. It's greyish brown all over, and the males have a black cap, a black top to their head, whereas the females have a sort of rusty coloured brown head. And they have a very high-pitched, quite fast song. It almost sounds a bit like a blackbird speeded up. And meanwhile, the chiffchaff, a small greenish, greyish bird, a little bit smaller than a blue tit, will spend the summer here. There's a number of different singing males throughout this particular part of the woodland. And as their name suggests, chiffchaff is their song. They go chiffchaff, chiffchaff, chiffchaff. Sounds a little bit more like sort of tick-tack, tick-tack. Here's the chiffchaff. And the chiffchaff is a common small warbler. It tends to winter in southern Europe and northern Africa, and it will be making its nest, along with the blackcap, very low down in the brambles and the grasses. In the cover, it'll be made out of leaves all woven together. And this habitat in front of us is perfect for that. It's got lots of young growth, and it means that the chiffchaff can find some nice places to nest down there. Now, the reason that this area for Troopers Hill is so good for many of these woodland, common woodland birds, and birds we might also spot in our garden, is because it's got a nice range of trees of different sorts of sizes. This means that there's trees which are very good as song posts where the birds can stand up high and sing, but also there's shrubby trees and fresh growing plants at a low level. And these in turn provide places where the birds can nest, but also it provides open, damp, dark areas where the birds can find food to feed their chicks with.
You now have a choice. The audio guide is going to take you on down the steps and along the woodland trail back to the field. But if you prefer, you can return back the way you came to the top of the steps and turn left. This will take you back to the field entrance where you started. To follow the guide, go down the steps in front of you and follow the path through the woods. Stop for the next section when you see the next trail marker. Well, we couldn't let you walk through the woods without talking about the trees themselves. So here is tree expert and dendrologist Tony Titchen to give you some background.
This woodland is very nice. It's got a mixture of native trees and what we call adventive trees, trees which have self-seeded themselves and have become fully established. Not many people know that in Britain we have really only about 35 native trees. You may wonder, what is a native tree? A native tree is a tree which has been here since the Ice Age. 8,000 years ago, the English Channel did not exist. 12,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. So native trees are trees which have become established up to 7,500 years ago. These trees have been established mainly by birds. Birds, as you know, like to eat acorns and other seeds, and they can bring them in to a country and they can start off the development of the trees. You must remember, of course, that we have had 4, possibly 5 ice ages, and various trees have been growing here during those times. A very interesting example would be the common walnut. Common walnuts used to grow here wild in Britain before the last ice age, but of course they don't now. Now here we don't obviously have 35 species of tree, but we do have about half a dozen truly native ones. Here on the woodland we have native the ash, the field maple. There are 2 wild species of hawthorn here in Britain. We have the southern European hawthorn, which is growing quite happily here, but also we have its hybridization with the Midland hawthorn. We have hornbeams here, which of course is a native tree, but these hornbeams have all been planted. There are several trees that you can see here in this woodland which we could think would be native, but they're not. There are sycamore. Now sycamore is not native to the British Isles. Instead it's native to the northern part of the Caucasus region of Europe. It's a tree which was introduced maybe 500 years ago. Another very common non-native tree is an oak tree, but not the common European oak or the Durmast oak, which we know have got leaves which are shed every year, but this one is an evergreen oak. We know it as the holm oak or the ilex oak with holly-like leaves. That particular tree is native to the Mediterranean region and grows quite wild in places like southern Spain and Crete, but unfortunately we tend to regard it as a weed because the birds do love, thus particularly the large birds, do love the acorns. The acorns are perfectly edible and the acorns are then taken by the birds to somewhere where they can eat them, and of course they so often drop them on the way, and of course the rest is history. The oak grows up and of course becomes an invasive weed.
Thanks, Tony. Now continue along the trail. You'll soon see a sign that will take you out onto Lamb Hill and turn right. A few yards further on, you'll see another path on your right again, with another signpost. Turn right and follow this path past the back of some houses. You can pick up the last part of our tour when you get to the next gate, which leads out onto Trooper's Hill Field again. Well, this brings you to the end of the audio guide. You are now back on Trooper's Hill Field. If you continue straight ahead, you'll return to where we started at the hill entrance. I hope you've enjoyed your visit and our guide. Friends of Troopers Hill will continue to look after the hill at our regular work parties, and you would be very welcome to join us, should you want to, as mentioned before. We organise many events throughout the year, from music concerts to family fun picnics and dog shows. So please do check our website for further information, www.troopers-hill.org.uk. Or you can sign up for our free quarterly newsletter, The Hill, by emailing membership@troopers-hill.org.uk. In the meantime, thank you for your time and interest. We hope to see you here again sometime. Bye.